better than we can be able to, because I'm told that we are expected to submit a report to the chief's office for in preparation for the 29th. So this meeting is part of that report that we need to do. We have two presentations today. One presentation we held it at bay yesterday. It's from Sanko and Mr. Ferris. And the second presentation is from Human Science Research Council, Mr. Hartland. And then we will take both presentations and go through the normal process of engaging with those presentations. Mr. Ferris.
Thank you, Chairperson. Morning, comrades. Chairperson, before I start my presentation, I just want to make a few comments. One, the executive history for us, both of us, Sanko and the department or the portfolio committee, that it is the first time that we make any presentation to Foreign Affairs portfolio committee. Secondly, Chairperson, you know, Foreign Affairs is quite foreign to Sanko, put it that way. It's a foreign language to us. We only know the language of housing, health, etc., or road transport. So be with us. We are not the intellectuals or the UWCs or UCTs. We are just the ordinary person in the street. I want you to bear with me, really. In fact, I am a guy, my first job, I was a cleaner, to put it. We also say that to you. Chairperson, you know, when I prepare the submission, common sense tells me that how do you budget Foreign Affairs when you, at the same time, deal with the foreign exchange rate? Because most of your, or two-thirds of your budget should cater for that particular aspect. When you spend 1 rand in South Africa on housing, you need to spend 7 or 8 rand on foreign affairs at the same time for that particular 1 rand. So, really, I don't know. Perhaps there should be a change somewhere, somehow, in terms of budgeting for foreign affairs. It should not be fit into South African perspective. But you should look at it as a global perspective. Chairperson, if I say I will read the presentation, I hope you got copies of it. We would like to thank the portfolio committee for the opportunity to make the submission. However, due to unforeseen circumstances, we only received this annual report of the department and as well as your strategic plan 36 hours ago. It was very little time for us really to make a full and comprehensive submission. Thus we hope that we will only cover the main concerns of Sanko in the submission. Chairperson, at our last working committee meeting, we were informed that the portfolio committee will invite us to make a representation here. And upon that announcement, I must say this with you, that a lot of us grumbled, why is it not the Department of Home Affairs? Because that is actually the department that we want to interrogate and not Foreign Affairs. However, Chairperson, when we as leaders listen to our fellow African sisters, African sisters and brothers, being from Congo, Nigeria, Comoros, etc. Or when we look for money from abroad to really make a boost in South Africa, we then start to realize that Foreign Affairs is of great concern to everyone. And in fact, the most great concern. Chairperson, our submission will focus on 5 major aspects that clearly need the attention. You can read through that aspect. I will elaborate rather on it. The one is revising and enhancing the role of government towards civil society on foreign affairs matters. Foreign interaction is widely regarded as one of the post-apartheid government's major areas of achievement, yet remains one of the most challenging. The many challenges in this instance to identify only one crucial challenge at home, example xenophobia, need critical and challenging interventions. Shenko questioned whether government put much emphasis on involving an armed civil society, stressed the status as to assist in these challenges. We are also questioning whether government uses its budget resources to equip civil society structures like Shenko with the necessary skills and training to train our community out there on various lessons such as the African Renaissance, NEPAD, African Union, African Peer Review Mechanism, globalization and its impact on civil society, etc. So no way the ordinary person on the street know of the particular methods. There was a survey, for example, in Gauteng, where they asked everyone on the street, what is NEPAD? No one, not a single person did know that. Oh, they only say we read, we hear something on the news, but we don't know what it is really. Once we have achieved these greater successes in changing the political construct abroad, the economic construct and people-driven understanding of globalization remain largely unchanged. The Department's strategic plan and budget really don't cater for this. Effective foreign policy engagement is not solely dependent on civil society organizations themselves. Obviously, the portfolio committee on foreign affairs should also be strengthened, as it does not seem to be currently very effective in its oversight role. That's our opinion, and that it could perhaps not be yours. The portfolio committee could become an important avenue for the public to engage and make submissions on foreign affairs policy related issues. Civil society organizations do not only have to deal with government and parliament on foreign affairs policy matters, but also have the power to engage in all forms of activities like cross-border networks and sector-to-sector linkages. Is government using civil society structures, such as Shenko, to network with other countries, or inviting civil society structures at the government's expense to do oversight work on achievement or failures of other countries? We don't do that. When government sends its people abroad, they don't take us or any other NGO with them. But it should rather be at the expense of that particular NGO, but that particular NGO is funded by, for example, Bush. You know that, whilst we are not funded by the Bush administration. The answer is no. The government is also missing out on important opportunity to tap into resources and expertise of civil society structures, which could complement government needs. At Shenko, we are saying, here we are, empower us, to empower communities, and indeed the global world. Changing the balances between the South and North, and within the South, and consolidation of African agenda. To achieve mere defensive reforms that the present developing countries seeking within the World Trade Organization, there would have to be major changes in the balance of power among governments within the WTO. Many of the developing country governments have made considerable advances in the understanding of the WTO, in large measure thanks to national and international NGO efforts with them and on their behalf. And many such governments seem to be taking significant steps in forming tactical alliances to defend their own country's interests, as the recent repeated settlements in the WTO indicate. But for this to be sustained and carried further, the majority of member states of the World Trade Organization, namely the African countries, have to be held together to resist the typical divide and the rule divide of the governments of the North. The Department of Foreign Affairs efforts to advance the developmental agenda of the South and strengthening cooperation among developing countries through active participation in groupings of the South too, and must remain in force to address the challenges of underdevelopment, political marginalization, or economic marginalization. Our contribution towards post-conflict reconstruction and development in Africa, with particular attention to the DRC or Burundi, etc., should bear fruit for the African agenda in particular. And greater participation in budgeting is of paramount importance. The role of civil society in the African Union and NIPA. Those of us who have been around for a while, say, person, that's before NIPA, there was a certain amount of agreement that Africa was a hopeless continent. You know where that agreement comes from, the North as well as, for example, the West country, such as America. They can leave it in the African Union, and with them, the feeling that a positive stance was being taken, and that African states were at last being brought together. Now they tell, they still think that Africa is in trouble. Libya has opened a door of opportunity and hope. One of the early criticisms of Libya was that it was a top-down approach. That this would be so is only natural, considering the state of the continent and the weaknesses of its institutions. In a document of Libya, this was acknowledged, and an attempt has been made to address the various criticisms that has been voiced with regard to NIPA. More information is contained in the African peer review mechanism, which is an excellent attempt to generate new processes pertaining good governance in Africa. Obviously, it is regarded as processes should be participatory. Democracy and development would not happen in Africa unless governments take civil society with them on these matters or issues or processes. In South Africa, we are fortunate that democracy is not fleeting or undemocratic. There is therefore no excuse in taking civil society on board on the decision-making processes. We need to distinguish clearly between NGOs and civil society, as broadly understood. The broader notion of civil society includes community-based organizations, trade unions, churches, etc. That is the broader notion of civil society and not NGOs only. We must be wary of equating civil society with NGOs, especially since Washington funds some of the NGOs that are critical of NIPA. The creation of NIPA in the African Union is uneven and an ongoing process. It is clear that some NGOs are beholden to foreign donors and in some cases abuse their positions. The African Union should not be beholden to a small group of visitors, NGOs, but must engage with the broader notion of civil society in Africa. Every African state has some kind of parliament, and this is where the political process takes place. That is the start of the political process within the broader context. This institution also serves as the interface between parliament and civil society. The question we ask is whether the portfolio committee will address the matter of engaging with the broader notion of civil society and how. Obviously, there is no easy answer. But if the portfolio committee starts with SANCO as the only single national community-based organization, government will already achieve a lot. Resource allocation by the department program. SANCO expressed gratitude towards the department chairperson for the manner in which the department spent its budget during the 2005-2006 financial year. Neither understanding nor overspending took place. And this confirms that the department is on the right track in terms of managing its financial resources. I want to applaud them. We know that, for example, at Parliament today, the Select Committee of Financial of Finance, they meet with various provincial governments or departments on the financing sessions, and there we get big problems regarding underspending or overspending, and really this never happened here at Foreign Affairs. We are, however, not pleased with the current non-funding approved allocations towards its 2007-2008 forthcoming budget proposal, and hoping that the Portfolio Committee will definitely make progressive informed statements to the Treasurer on the Department's proposal. Human capital management, we welcome the significant improvement of representation of black people. However, we know that the Employment Equity Act compliances need further attention with regard to representation of people with disabilities and women representation. We furthermore note that there is still a huge gap between colored Indian and white employees at the department. Example, at the legislature, senior officers and manager level, you see that there is 99 white in comparison with only 17 colored and 32 Indian. And when you look at the population, there's a different picture. So the equity is not there in mind there. In conclusion, Chairperson, we trust that the submission shall get your broad approval and close scrutiny, given the private role of the department to advance the African Union. I thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Probably sitting there at the department will be drawing some smiles if a community-based organization sees the department as doing its budget very well. It means that it's not only those who work with the department that appreciate that. There are other people who see that. I'll be sitting there smiling and say, oh, okay. And having received a number of issues yesterday, I will look at today and say, it's a good start for us. The day was not for us yesterday, but today we started the morning with some enthusiasm. I must indicate that the very essence of this public hearing to deal with the issue that we are raising on the 2000-2008 budget. We are planning to have a meeting sometime next week with Treasury to further discuss that and understand how Treasury makes its own decision. They handle the path, they could be able to explain things that you may not understand, and based on that, will then be able to be persuaded. Another issue of importance, and probably that needs to be further pursued, and I know that the department is here, they will also say that we followed with enthusiasm the question of the employment equity, and I think at some point, the whole government could not meet the targets on people who are disabled who are supposed to have been employed at the time. And they shifted the target line. They continue shifting the target line. And I think in the last year's budget vote, we were told that the department has done well, but it has not met the target. I think the target was about 3%, if I'm not mistaken. And by that time, they were sitting at about 1.5 or 2%. It's something that we need to keep an eye on, not only the department. I suspect that those who are engaged in community work, they need to then look at not only the Department of Foreign Affairs, but the government, how to perform on that particular aspect. What is it that we do? And what is it that we can do to do more in this particular aspect of things? The other issue that you raised is quite an interesting one.
in regard to the way communities raise issues. You raised the issue related to communities that comes to South Africa, and you raised the fact that sometimes they get exposed to what is called xenophobic behavior. I attended a conference in Spain now recently on international migration and immigration, and how then migrants get treated by the host countries, and how migrants contribute in fact to the economic development of the host country. And of course it has its own economic and social problems that brings. I do not have a sense that in South Africa we've been able to understand the issues around migration and immigration. I think when after 1994, we were quite alarmed to see a number of South Africans leaving. And I want to draw a line here, because the understanding at the time had two different meanings. One, there were people who were leaving South Africa because they assumed that with the change of political power, the country is going to sink, and therefore they want to run away before it happens. And others were running away because they felt that when blacks take government, they'll become victims. So take that group out of the equation. But I'm talking about people who left the country because they were in pursuit of better economic prosperity. There were two reactions to those two people. The first group was predominantly white, and the second group was predominantly black and African, specifically. And I do not think that we were able as a country to understand that movement. I think at some point we took a view that those who were leaving were actually less patriotic than those who were remaining. And I think in that process, we lost the value sometimes that our people, when we export our skills, what is it that we gain as a country in return? And I think in that process, we lost that. As a result of that, our understanding of those who come into our country then became problematic, as we understand, as how we understand them. We have tended to regard those who come into our country as people who potentially will create problems. And because maybe that is because of the nature of the South African society, that ourselves, internally, we're coming out of isolation amongst ourselves as South Africans. We did not have the opportunity to know each other. And now you have other people coming in that process of trying to find what will be termed a South African as a country. And then it creates its own problem. I'm very reluctant, in fact, in most cases, to argue that South Africans are xenophobic. And my reluctance comes at the view that I take, I say, they are not xenophobic, but it's a problem of experience. It's a problem of lack of understanding as to what this movement means, because South Africans themselves, among themselves, are struggling to understand their own selves. And therefore, when a third element comes in, it creates a confusion in that particular pool. And therefore, I always find it, personally, I've never accepted that we are xenophobic. I've always said it's because of our inexperience of dealing with the problem and dealing with the challenge that creates an impression that we are xenophobic as a country. Because if we are xenophobic, then there's something that needs to be explained. You know, if you look at South Africa in the 60s, there were a number of Mozambicans, Malawians, Zimbabweans, Botswana, Lesotho in this country. Some of them today are in third generation. So now, if your grandfather was originally from Malawi, and you are a third generation in that family, how xenophobic can you be towards Malawians when you know that your own ancestors are actually Malawians? But your inability to can deal with your own internal identity problem, and when the next person comes in, it creates that confusion. And that's why I've always been very reluctant to say we are xenophobic. I've always said, maybe I'm denying the fact that we are xenophobic, but I always said it's because
our experience when we got our liberation and we had this influx of people at the time when ourselves were trying to understand ourselves as a country. You move to a suburb, the next day the whole street is up for sale. Because the community you are moving into don't know you. And they still hold the prejudice that they had. So once you're still struggling with that, then you have other people arriving. It creates whole problems. And of course, it's a matter that I think we need to pursue and discuss. I raised it the last time in the portfolio committee to say we need to discuss these issues of migration very thoroughly. Outside them being an issue of home affairs, but as a police in the country, how do we deal with this particular phenomenon? If you look at Europe today, the rise of the right wing in Europe, they use the very same issues of migration. The conservatives and the right wing in Europe use the issue of migration as a threat to their societies, and therefore block whoever comes in into their countries. Europe has the same problem. But thank you very much. What we are going to suggest we do, we are going to take the second presentation, and possibly if you could be seated there so that when we deal with questions, we are able to answer for your sins. We'll take this right away, the second presentation from Mr. Hartland from the Human Science Research Council. And possibly deal with the questions as a whole. I think I met your colleague, Tillet, in Palestine, where he was making with your head in Palestine. He was giving a lecture on the viability of the two-state and whether it's viable or not viable. And with all the problems there, it's quite an interesting subject. Ms. Hartland, I'm going to leave ourselves to your head. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Morning, colleagues, members. I'm from the Human Sciences Research Council. Very briefly, if you're not familiar with us, we are a statutory organization. We are funded largely by Parliament, so I work for you. The process through which what I'm presenting here today is that we had a workshop yesterday. The HSRC represents about 200 research specialists, many of whom have PhDs. We're an independent thinking organization, and we shared ideas around the budget. So, you know, there'll be areas that I'll talk to you about that are not my particular expertise, that I'm sort of representing the ideas of some of my sort of scholarly colleagues. And therefore, if it comes to questions, and you ask me some questions, I might not be able to catch some of the nuances that some of my colleagues are able to present. So we do have close ties to the Department of Foreign Affairs. As the Chair mentioned, we are in the Middle East at the moment. We're working on a project with the Department of Foreign Affairs. We were involved in the African Peer Review Mechanism. We regularly do workshops with the Department. We have a number of projects on the go. We even have expertise in migration, Chair. Perhaps that's something we can talk about at some point. Maybe you'd like us to come and do a presentation on the latest trends, migration trends, and so on. But we're here to talk about the foreign affairs budget, and I thank you for inviting us. You'll find that when it comes to civil society that some of our comments overlap directly with Sanko. And I must say it's great to see Sanko being part of this process. It's exactly this kind of engagement between local and global which allows the positive harnessing of globalization. To allow local interests to feed into global policies is exactly the right thing to be doing, I think. Okay, let me move on. I've got about 7 points to make. I haven't given you copies of the presentation. I will, when I get back to the office, forward them to you. I've written all over these ones, so I didn't want to give these to you, but I will make sure that you get them later today or at the next possible moment through the Secretariat. Let me start off by saying that we're not as the HSRC and as Democracy and Governance, which is my particular unit within the HSRC, so I'm not representing the entire institution, but a collection of researchers within our Democracy and Governance program. We're not going to deal with particular line items. You've had some of that in the last couple of days, but we're really going to be looking at the underlying principles and emphases within the budget and raising some ideas around our thoughts on that. And I hope that'll be of some use to you. In general terms, we thought that the current budget and the NCEF vision of future departmental budgets are very expansionary, very ambitious. The vision for the department and its representatives is a growing role in Africa and globally, more missions, high level of spending on infrastructure, more property, more technology, above inflation increases. It's very sort of expansionary, positive profile and intention and vision within the department, and we think that's entirely appropriate as South Africa steps up to take more of a global role. But in doing so, there are a number of issues that that may be raised, in particular the notion of capacity, and I'll get onto that in a moment, and that's really my first major point. But as an aside, and on the general issues, it's sort of noted by some of our colleagues that Africa is very much involved in a race for energy resources at the moment. And we have the concern that this can be very destructive for development in Africa if it's not handled in the correct way, and the department really needs to play a role in helping to format an African response to this race for energy resources among the current global superpowers. So that's sort of part of the context that we see. On a question of capacity, we have the department has these incredibly ambitious plans, 3 new embassies every year, representation across Africa by 2009-10, new embassies in Japan and so on. Do we have the capacity to meet these expectations? The budget indicates the plan for the expansion of the Foreign Service Institute, for the hiring of unemployed graduates. It mentions the partnership with UNISA. We're not concerned with the scope of the department's planned engagement, but with the depth. Do we have the depth to provide the skilled personnel that are going to be able to sustain this kind of ambitious expansion program? We understand, for instance, that while the department is recruiting, the retention is a problem, and we know all about that. It's a problem with us, and I think in many of the public sector departments as well. Retention of young, skilled, ambitious graduates isn't always an easy thing to do. And if retention is a problem, are we gathering people with sufficient links to language and financial skills who are going to be able to act in these new consulates and missions to be able to do the sort of work that this budget envisages? Now, there seem to be about 3 levels of capacity that the department needs to look at. One is the notion of policy research and analysis. Now, where things stand at the moment, we understand, is that the department acts largely as a clearinghouse. It takes it gathers information and passes it on. It's not really involved in the generation of policy. It does great work in terms of hosting conferences and workshops. But do the South African embassies and does the foreign affairs structure have the skills to collect and analyze the data that is essential to guide South African policy? Is the department engaged in policy formulation to a sufficient extent? Does it have the capacity to do that? We're not sure that it does. Secondly, the institute itself. It was mentioned in quite a few places in the budget, is the next generation of diplomats being fast-tracked rapidly enough in order to provide the department and all its different goals and embassies with the requisite technical, linguistic, and economic, particularly economic skills? We're not sure. We can't read that from the budget. We see there are plans. We perhaps ask you to take this up further with the institute. And finally, the level of capacity is around the Presidential Advisory Unit, obviously extremely important strategic team within the Department of Foreign Affairs. Are the resources there sufficient? Are the personnel sufficiently skilled to provide the presidency with the kind of information and data that it needs to do its job adequately? So that's the whole question of capacity, is something that concerns us from the budget. I'll leave that there. Morning, Douglas. The second point is on the issue of principles. The principles of the budget are, as the Department of Foreign Affairs, I mentioned on page 30 of the budget vote, there are six of them. We do agree and support each of them, and it's important that they act as a lodestone of current South African policy. But there's one issue that we wanted to raise with the principles, and that is that we find that an engagement with Asia, and in particular the building of a global South identity with countries like Brazil and India, is not really reflected in the guiding principles of the Department of Foreign Affairs and of our foreign policy. It's very clear to us and to many that China, for instance, is engaging with our economies throughout the continent on a daily basis and an increasing extent. And yet our policy has no principle for coping with this particularly. We worry that without a sort of Asian emphasis being stated somewhere in the department's statement of mission, if you like, that we're therefore not going to formulate an adequate or informed response to the whole question of our relationship with the Asian subcontinent, but also with the South in as a whole. And we wondered whether that isn't something that's worth revisiting. It's true that, we can't spend unlimited amounts on all regions, and we do have to have priorities. It is noticeable on page 36 of the budget vote that Asia and Australasia are the poor cousins of our foreign relations expenditure, both in terms of bilateral relations management and in diplomatic representation. And we wonder whether that has to do more with our theoretical vision of South Africa's role rather than the actual realities of what's happening in our economy and politically at the moment. So we wonder whether there shouldn't be more of an emphasis on Asia and on the South-South relations. My next point is on the United Nations. I just have a few more points. It's a great source of pride to all South Africans that we, the country, now serves on the Security Council of the United Nations. And it's part of our growing stature in the international community, and it's something that I think we're all very proud about. But this exposure to high-level global politics is a bit of a double-edged sword, or a mixed blessing, and I say this for a couple of reasons. Serving on the Security Council affects the extent to which South Africa can be hands-on in approach to Africa. South Africa is excluded from being a primary mediator, for instance, in African conflicts, if it sits on the Security Council. So while we could take part on the major global stage, we wonder whether that isn't at the very same time tying our hands when it comes to the theater of interest, which is of particular interest to us, which is Africa. And secondly, membership of the Security Council should provide the opportunity to embolden the African agenda, to provide stimulus to continental objectives and priorities. But the Security Council itself, given the issues that it deals with, is an extremely big distraction. It allows our energies and resources to be drawn away from the African agenda and toward the Middle East and to other theaters of conflict and interest. An example of this, as I understand, was that when we were appointed to the Security Council, we withdrew some of our senior diplomatic staff from the Addis Ababa mission, and we now have two ambassadors in the UN, so there's an example of an immediate reshuffling of our resources away from Africa and into the global stage, and we're worried that our ability to intervene or to engage with the African agenda is being compromised perhaps by our role on the Security Council. I'm not saying we should pull out of the Security Council, I'm just saying it's something for you to think about and for the department to think about to try to ensure that doesn't happen. There is a suggestion, for instance, that we might tear down our engagement on some of the Security Council issues and focus in particular on African issues. And that the very act of gathering data and information about, for example, the Middle East in order to intervene in that process is preventing us from gathering data and information about other issues which may be of interest. So this is reflected to some extent in the budget, and that we do pay our fees to the United Nations, but our membership and our current position in the UN has required some reshuffling of resources, and we are just raising of the alarm bells, but we ask you to think about how that might be affecting our main priorities in terms of the principles. So speaking of that, I want to speak a couple more points. NEPAD and the AU. It's clear from the budget that the African Union is very well elaborated within the budget. Various principles and activities are clearly marked and apparently well funded. But it seems to us that within that, NEPAD, which is meant to be the overarching framework, has been underemphasized within the budget and in policy. And it appears to some of our sort of experts within democracy and governance that there's a process or apparent process of delinking in which the African Union and its interests are being delinked or separated to some degree from NEPAD. And as a result, we are sort of directing more resources into the AU priorities, which is around peacekeeping, conflict resolution, election support, and away from the economic development and partnerships that NEPAD suggests. So it's a bit of a sort of nuanced paradigm, and to be honest, it's not my specific field, but a couple of our specialists expressed that this was a matter of some concern, and that our energies must go toward revitalizing NEPAD and clarifying its developmental agenda at this time. So we need to revisit NEPAD's goals and adjust them accordingly. An aspect of this may be giving the African Renaissance Fund, which is really the main tool of the department's engagement in Africa, more of an economic as well as a socio-economic focus. Peacekeeping and election support are naturally important, but so is reconstruction and the revitalization of strong African economies. The African Renaissance Fund Act, of course, allows South Africa to mobilize other institutions, to raise other funds, to increase the significance of the fund's intervention. I see from the budget that the contribution to that fund increases dramatically over the medium term, the framework, the MTF. But we do wonder whether this has been done adequately. It's not a question of just putting more money in from a departmental budget. It may be a question of mobilizing more support around the fund and using it to leverage support and funding from elsewhere as well. We wonder whether that's happening, given that this is our main tool of intervention. So we're arguing that perhaps the Renaissance Fund, even though it's going to be receiving an increasing contribution from the department, shouldn't indeed be considerably strengthened. On peacekeeping, further issues of capacity are evident, though not from the budget, and these include the training of troops and of pilots. We understand that we've generally done a good job of peacekeeping, but that there are some internal capacities with regard to skills and also the need to build capacity for peacekeeping on the continent as a whole and not just for us to take on the responsibility largely ourselves. The department is overstretched in terms of peace and support operations. The department may want to consider downsizing the number of countries where it is actively involved. Is there a need for peacekeeping troops in Eritrea and Ethiopia? What is needed here is perhaps to support negotiations leading to a common understanding between the two countries. The situation in northern Mali is also not a major threat and perhaps does not require the deployment of the SANDF, when a small ECOWAS force could do the job just as cheaply. So I think we need to sort of re-look particularly our peacekeeping operations in Africa, and where they're not necessary to scale them down. Countries like Botswana, Namibia, and Nigeria do have the resources and can afford to fund their own human resources and technical development projects. And where they require technical secondments in South Africa, they can pay for that themselves. Zambia probably needs more help acquiring modern technology, but has more than enough skilled human resources, and the Department of Foreign Affairs needs to develop more cost-effective ways of transferring skills to Zambia and also to Mozambique. On the issue of civil society, which my colleague from SANCO mentioned, we did talk about this in our workshop, and we're largely in agreement with what SANCO said earlier. We do think that more engagement with the civic organizations and with private organizations is imperative. There are institutions, for instance, the Nelson Mandela Foundation, that does have interests and projects that overlap with the interests of the department. These need to be explored. And generally speaking, we didn't get the sense from the budget that the department is serious about building durable partnerships with civil society. And we would urge, as my colleague from Sankara did earlier, that this be revisited. For exactly the reason that engaging local interests and local voices in the dynamics of global politics is exactly the way of positively harnessing globalization and making sure that our South African voice is heard. So that also has implications for capacity in the department and also for the budget. And my final point is on efficiencies. And you know, when you look at the columns of numbers and the budget, it's very hard, if not impossible, to get a sense. You can see the money is being spent, but is it possible? It's not possible to see where the money is being spent well. And we wondered whether there are monitoring structures in place, or whether any sort of activities are being done to ensure that while this money is, three billion rand for the budget, that while the money is being spent and the budget is very ambitious and expansionary and lots of capital is being put aside to fund this new vision for the department, we'd also like to know that what is being spent, what exists already, is being cared for, is being maintained, is being spent efficiently, and that's impossible for us to tell by looking at the numbers. But perhaps there are ways of doing that internally. And we would like a clearer sense that the department is constantly working to improve efficiencies in the department, and that spending procedures and policies are being revisited and revised, and that funds, generally speaking, are being efficiently utilized. Two minor points to close off. One, the entertainment budget, 40 million a year, entirely necessary, maybe so, but I wouldn't mind hearing the department defend that. There's a lot of money to be spending on cocktail party background music. And secondly, the budget assumes that the rand will be depreciating over the course of the next year, in fact over the next 5 years, and that may be true. It may also be true that depreciation happens a great deal faster than we expect. And it's also possible that the rand may appreciate over the next 5 years a great deal faster than we expect. And perhaps no other department is exposed to fluctuations in exchange rate value as the department. We wonder whether, if there are wild variances either way, whether the department is in a position to be able to cope with what those variations might entail. For instance, if the rand drops to 50 rand per dollar, what will happen to our plans to put embassies and missions on every country in Africa? What will happen to our sort of current situation? Are we hedging rands in a way with the Department of Finance to ensure that the ambitious plans that we do have as a country are able to be met in the next 3 to 5 years? And it's very possible that dramatic depreciation could seriously undermine the department's plans from beginning to end. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You raised the 40 million as an amount for background music and drinking coffee. And I suspect that any diplomat will defend that. And any diplomat will give you a thesis as to why that money is needed. Because it is argued at some point that in the process of doing work, you need that background music. You need that double touch to invigorate the flow of ideas. That's what we can tell. You raise very critical things in regard to what the budget, the expansionary nature of the budget, and the fact that the budget seems to be projecting a growth of the department in a particular direction. But you raise a contradiction that becomes of interest, that once you project this expansionary route, your human resource seems to be not following that budgetary process or that expansionary vision that the budget seems to represent. And that raises quite an interesting how then do you bring the two together. And you raise the issue around FFI and the search capacity
of the department. I'm aware that they've set up an entity that's supposed to do analysis and process information. How it has so far been put in place and working, I'm not certain about it. Maybe it's something that the committee needs to follow up. I know that at the time it was still being set up. But as to what happened subsequently to it being set up at the initial stages to what it is now, something else. But we've argued in the committee for some time, and we've raised this thing, and we're told that there is an engagement between the two ministries that will be affected. We've argued in the committee that you're sitting with an institute like Africa Institute, that in my view is not properly utilized, it's not properly placed. It's placed in science and technology. I do not believe that it belongs there. Because it's basically your an institute that deals with research and information rather than your typical science and technology institute. And we've been saying to the department, move that institute there, restructure it, put it in place, and then use that institute as your entity for analysis and all that. Then do your that institute position it in such a way that it's able to take knowledge from all other entities that exist in the country. So that you do not necessarily have to create another entity in the department. But of course they opted to create an entity in-house. And sometimes that creates duplication. When there's an entity that in my view, I might be wrong, but in my view, it's idling. It's not really been capacitated. It's not been given the attention that I think it must be given. And we've argued, we've raised that, even in the last budget vote, we've raised the fact that that institute must be relocated and be utilized properly. And then you'll then be able to get your FSI, your training arm of that entity, and this one being a research arm, and be able to interact with universities, with all other institutions that you raise that could have interest in the development of policy. Then you have the department being able to do what you are raising as the capacity to can generate policy development and be able to provide the necessary information that will be required at any given point in time. Because you raised the question that I think we need to pursue the ability of the government to generate policies and its ability to then, having generated those policies, having fortified those policies, being implementing those policies. Now, if you expect the government to be a generator of knowledge and it be able to sift through that knowledge and pick up relevant elements and at the same time implement some of the issues that we'll have agreed on, I do not believe that at any given point they'll be in the capacity to do that. Hence, you then need these institutes that surround the department, that the department is then able to take that knowledge from those entities, be able then to do that. You do not require a desk in the department to generate knowledge. You could do that using the FSI students that are there, because part of their work will be to do research. And in doing research, you can come up with a number of other ideas and other policy options that are available that, as of now, we have not been able to explore because of the nature of the organization that it's not able to generate that sufficient knowledge. And I'm raising this because I'm contrasting the expansionary nature of the department and its capacity to can be able to provide the human resources and the skills that are needed to do that particular work. You've raised the last point that you've raised, the fact that The budget indicates that money has been spent and it's been spent well, but you're saying that you're unable to read whether the well expenditure is actually efficient. Because you could spend the money very well, but then whether are you efficient in that expenditure is something else. The department will then argue that the fact that they are scattered around Tshwane could be also an impediment on that efficiency. Because you don't have a department that you could be able to move in between the scattered around. And hopefully that once they have one house, they are all housed there, they'll then be able to to do that. But of course, we will raise that efficiency issue and see whether are we sufficiently and efficiently spending that money. I agree with you on the African Financial Fund. My view is that we have not appreciated what this fund could do for this country. We were still treated on ad hoc arrangements, and probably part of its bulk is to deal with issues of peacekeeping, and we are neglecting the economic investment and the building the outcomes of peace. With those words, I will allow members to interact with our presenters to raise questions or comments, and in doing so, we could also have a view that says it's so clear that we don't have questions. So, Honourable Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I know that we have an excellent chairperson who knows how to close the doors, make a good response, and we take everything. Now we can in fact simply say that it's all there. Just like yesterday he made a nice closure, and when we left somebody said, what's called as well, they know in that language what it means. Now, can I just make a few remarks on this issue of efficiency which you ended with? Yes, I can see that that is necessary, but then I look at how do you draw efficiency in political objectives like human rights, peacekeeping, stability, and diplomatic objectives. But I'm sure you can do that in two different ways. You could be a libertarian and concentrate on the process and monitor the process, or you could be a consequentialist and look at the end, the outcome. So I don't know, you may have to enlighten us how to deal with that one here efficiently. The other thing that I also pick up with you and with Sanko is this critical question of the civil society, the partnership. I think we had that also yesterday with the unions. That we need to, yes, we are democratic. You say that in Sanko paper. But what we need really is to become, to have this participatory democracy where we put these NGOs and others on board. But you're also adding the churches, and I'm not quite sure about the church. At what level do you do that with the church and what you say? Because I would have thought the church was going to be the conscience of the state. Now, I don't equalize or equate the church with the state, but I would want the church to be the conscience of the state and not be really dictated to by the state. And now, with NEPAD and AU, I think you need to help us here also, because you're looking at the contradiction there between AU and NEPAD. But I thought when we initiated this, AU was to us a geopolitical unit, which we needed to have before we can have anything in Africa. We needed to have, just like they had the OAU, you needed that geopolitical unity to bring in all these states. But then when we established NEPAD, it was, to us now it was an arm, a geo-economic entity of the EU. And therefore there should not be any clashes or contradictions. But I'm sure you've noticed the contradictions there. We are learning, we need to to look at it. And you also mentioned the interest in Africa, the African agenda, the UN Security Council. I thought we will weigh the priorities there and said when we said today, whether it's a non-permanent seat, but we are going to draw the attention of the world to the plight of Africa. And hence in March when we took that seat today, we really talked about how we could be assisted in peacekeeping and the UN peacekeeping force into Darfur, Sudan, and so on. I thought we weighed those priorities and thought, no, we could be in a position to draw more attention away from those other areas like the Middle East, Iraq, Iran, and even Asia, who are taking the attention of the world, including resources and funds towards them. We wanted to make sure that we break that cycle. And I don't know whether we've managed to do it, but that was our major objective to do it. And I think we agreed as a country that this was supposed to be what we do. Let me just finish my comments. I mustn't be equated with the chairman here. With Sanko, now I've mixed my notes now here. Yeah, no, with Sanko, they came out with this xenophobia, and the chairman was saying, no, he doesn't think that we are xenophobic. He thought maybe we don't understand ourselves. We don't understand our identity, and therefore we may not be xenophobic. I somehow agree with you there, but not so much. Because you see, if I steal bread, I steal a book, I steal a shirt, and then there is a rational why I did those things. But I'm still a thief, you see. Yes, there's a reason why I stole bread, shirt, but I'm a thief. You see, we don't understand these things, and therefore we become xenophobic. We are when we don't understand these things. We react that way, you see. Not all of us, but we do react that way. We say they're taking our jobs, they're doing this, that. We do act that way. And if you listen to this African peer review mechanism, there's a summary there which puts in xenophobia also, that there is xenophobia in our country, which is a problem. Lingering racism is there. Underdevelopment, they are putting all those things in there. So to an extent, yes, I agree with you that there's a rationale for all these things. But we may have to find a better word for that rationale. But at this point in time, it's known as xenophobia. Now, I also wanted to say to Sanko, I think we heard this yesterday, you were emphasizing this role a lot, that you need to be consulted, you need to come on board and so on. I also tend to believe so, because what we are doing really, whether in various departments, we are doing this in the name of the citizens of our country. And therefore, I think you are fighting or struggling for the aspirations of the people to be heard. Lastly, I like your comment there when you say that we trust that this admission will get your broad approval and close scrutiny, given the pivotal role of the Department of Foreign Affairs to advance the African dream. Then it simply reminded me of when we were at the workshop. It was a workshop in Limpopo. There was a lady who made a nice poem there, Lebu Mashini, so you know her. The title of the poem was, "You and I, we are the keepers of the dream." I like that. Thank you, sir.
Starting on the last point of the African dream, I don't know if there is consensus this is Sanko, or there is any research done by Human Science Research Council on the question of the dream. Is there consensus on the African dream between NGOs, civil society, and government? If there is consensus on the dream, let's assume that there is, at best. So the question arises, what is it to be done? Who does what? What are our different roles? We are saying from government, and I think you agree with this because you make up impossible, that without the partnership between government, civil society, NGOs, churches, trade unions, etc., there can be no transformation of our country. It is not the government's responsibility only. Now, if I were to borrow a term used by Dr. Kosani here, in terms of participatory democracy. The question that emanates from that participatory democracy, which you have put alluded to, what participatory responsibility is there between NGOs and civil society to enhance and make possible the the programs put into place by government? And for all intents and purposes, let's say that the policies are driven by government. There should be consultation. There has not been appropriate consultation. But while there is going to be consultation on the one hand, and should there be consultation, to what extent will the responsibility be shared? Now, I disagree with the point of that the churches are the conscience of government, or should be. That is in a non-ideal society. And I'm not for a moment saying that we are an ideal society. The conscience of our society is our constitution and not the churches. The churches have its role to play, we have another role to play. That's the one point. And this is just a comment to my colleague here. In respect of civil society, to what extent do you engage us? Do you take the initiative? Do you make recommendations, or do you wait for it to happen when others make it happen? So you talk of the African dream, and in the context of the African dream, to what extent are South African civil societies and NGOs playing their role transnationally for the African dream? What is it that civil society does? What has it done? What is a track record transnationally? I believe there are some, but they are not adequate. So for us to relate your comments in relationship to your budget to implement by policy, because the budget basically is the instrument by which we translate these policies into projects. I would like to pose a question, perhaps not to be answered here. You may make a note of it if you think it's important, to find out and investigate that what are the roles, what roles do civil society and NGOs play? Now, having said that, I want to add again, something that I've said, the partnership that's required for the African dream cannot be realized by governments alone. Civil society the churches are integral, religious institutions, to be correctly presented, because they are not only churches, they are religious institutions, will have to play that role. In concert, not as evangelical entities, civil society or trade unions for that matter, not to propound a particular ideological position, because there are different ideas. Because there are different ideological positions all over the continent. And what we are saying from our government here, that each one of us have a separate but integral role to play to make the African dream possible. My last question posed to civil society. Is civil society, it's a very important component for the advancement of a democratic society. Civil society is very important. But is civil society going to assume the role of being professional critics only? Or are they going to become participants in processes and programs? So what I'm saying to you, sir, that yes, our budget is good sometimes, bad sometimes, realizable at some times and not realizable at other times, overstretched most times. And I'm saying this as a fellow compatriot, that it is very easy for me to evaluate what civil society does not do. Equally, it is very easy for civil society to say to me, it's what government does not do. But unless there is consensus, unless there is a co-responsibility, and unless this responsibility, participate in this responsibility, criticism and observations become a bit superfluous. I mean, a bit hard, but because we are talking to our fellow South Africans, we need to be self-critical. And I'm arguing for that self-criticism. Tough, but true. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor. Franco, I think the presenter did a good job. Despite your trepidation in the beginning and your view that you may have been unable to do your job properly, I think you did very well. Not only in the paper, but in the way you presented your paper. Just to echo what the last speaker said, I think it's also my view that whereas prior to 1994, the policies of the government then were exclusive. Post-94, we have an inclusive government by way, for example, of various structures. And this is also true with the AU. Various structures that are inclusive. The challenge that we have now is civil society and other institutions actually engaging with these structures proactively to achieve the common goals that we have. To give an example, the Pan African Parliament is sitting right now in Midrand. I haven't seen so far organizations like yours, COSATU and others, not only talking about marches, which is a common phenomenon, but people actually going there, there are committees of that parliament, getting involved, putting their agenda across through those committees, and promote the goals that the organizations have. Sometimes in concert with government, even if that is not the case. So I think that's the challenge, that we need to move away from the past where, because of exclusion, we were throwing stones at the establishment. I think the challenge now is to actually use the space that has been provided post-94 to construct what that which we want. So I think I agree with the last speaker on that. To the HSRC, I think I'd like to put the challenge equally to you and to us, given your expertise, that I think we need to work together more. You opened your input by
indicating how close you work with the department. I think we need to emulate that and do the same at the parliamentary level, because we have the common objectives and aims. I think I would appeal for a closer relationship from you and from us. I also endorse your observation with regard to NEPAD. Now, on the issue of capacity, if I recall, far back in 2002, the president raised this issue, and he raised the fear at the time that as the government is engaging in this expansionary role, which is necessary, he raised the question whether there was capacity in the department in general to support this vision. And I agree with the chairperson in that up to now there doesn't seem to have been an adequate response to this issue that we have raised, which in my recollection has been raised far back in 2002 and in various State of the Nation addresses. So I agree with the observation. And again, here I think in line with what our colleague Comrade Mewa, the challenge really is to actually do something about these things. We can keep on observing and observing until this term is over. We come back to the other term and we observe these things. I think your institution has to use its own influence in this regard to see how it can sensitize and put more effort to ensure that this capacity issue is being dealt with. Thank you very much.
Chairperson, thank you very much. I've greatly appreciated the opportunity of listening to some of the academics who've been here and civil society representatives. I am sorry that I wasn't able to attend the Sanco presentation. I was busy with other works of mercy, but I have read the submission which they made. There are many questions I'd like to ask, but I'm not going to this time. I just want to focus on two matters. I understand that Suzanne Foss is one of our MPs, and in fact one of our representatives on the Pan-African Parliament, has written a newspaper article today discussing the PAP. Regrettably, I haven't had an opportunity of reading it. So I don't know whether her views are the same as mine. But I wondered whether our presenter has views, and if you've already covered this, then I sincerely apologize, and you must tell me to shut up. Has views about the Pan-African Parliament. I suspect that it's not getting the attention that it should get, and that's from all of us in Africa. It's also from the media. There's hardly any media coverage of what goes on there, and that must be a feeling that the PAP isn't discussing matters that are relevant or of immediate concern to one's interests. I also get the feeling that it's sort of taking too long before that parliament becomes properly established. It seems to me that it's grossly under-resourced, that they're trying to run it from Tanzania or somewhere else, and it's not getting the momentum it should. And I wondered if you've got views about that, and views about what we could do to help it become established, because I think it's a hugely important voice for Africa and for the future. And the second aspect that I'd like to ask your views about is this whole question of the United States of Africa, which is being discussed now in Durban. My view is that it's 50 years away at least, and by spending time and resources and energy on discussing what is an African dream, but discussing it now instead of the steps that are necessary before one can get there, I think we're just wasting time and energy and resources. We've got so many problems that need to be tackled and in a systematic way before we're in a position to talk about a closer relationship. And when you think of just the aims of the African Union itself, to which we're all committed, the AU's Constitutive Act, the DEPAD, all of those things, do you think it would be possible to sort of spell out some sort of a roadmap or whatever and say, before you get to the end of the dream, if that's what one wants, of an African Union, then one needs to do all of the following things and tackle them in a systematic way with targets and dates and who's responsible. Thank you very much.
I'm going to open to you. You can decide who starts to ask the question.
I don't have many answers. I also do have only comments on all these issues raised, but definitely I think I need to answer some of the particular matters. The issue of xenophobia. Chairperson, what we try to say in this document is, when this particular community that try to say to particular communities that come from Nigeria or Congo, no, you can't make business here, in the Inkayansa, for example. It did happen there. How can government use Sanko there to intervene in that particular matter? That is what we're trying to say here. We're not saying, yes, the word xenophobia should be the word, or there is xenophobia. We're not saying that. We're just reusing that term because the term is known to us. There's no other known term to us. That is the issue. And yes, we say government should use Sanko to engage our members on those particular matters. The churches, Chairperson, I'm not speaking on behalf of the churches, but surely the Council of Churches will not accept what you say, the National Council of Churches. And as I say, when you look at the broader term or the broad notion of civil society, we say we cannot exclude any organization. Yes, I'm not saying we need to go and to look into tough clubs or dark clubs. No, I'm saying look at national-based community organizations or groupings. That is what we refer to. Not regional organizations or issue-based organizations. You know, you get an organization that only will fight evictions. That is the only issue that organization. You cannot go to such organizations. You need to look at into organizations that look at the community as a whole or development as a whole. The committee. Yeah, what role does civic and NGO play at the moment? Yeah, I will keep that in abeyance and perhaps try to develop a paper on that or ask your assistance. Okay. Thank you. Chairperson, yes, the other issue about any recommendations, do we as civil society really engage government? Yes, these civil society organizations do engage government effectively, but Sanko, we are honest in this, we don't engage with government effectively. as it should be. Because of the very, of the mere reason, because of funding problems, what is saying softly, you know that resources, we don't have any resources. You say, for example, besides we have a parliamentary office here at Parliament, why don't you give SANCO also a parliamentary office? I'm just raising these issues. You resource certain organizations, but then you exclude other organizations. If IDASA may, for example, go to the African Union or to whatever engagement at the international level because they got the funding, we don't have any funding to do that. And IDASA is not representing the voiceless, which I would say softly, well, they're not representing the broader community, they're only representing intellectuals. Intellectuals, or themselves. Yeah, that's what they don't have members. They must only one member. Key person, then the, did I left out anything? Did I left out anything? Is there anyone that, did I cover you?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for your input from the members there, many of which were sort of additions rather than questions specifically, and I'm grateful for that. The Honourable Member Skosana mentioned a few points. I don't think there's a contrast or a conflict between efficiency and political objectives. I think good financial management fits into whatever political shell you want to put it into. And all I was really saying was that we can't tell from the numbers on the page whether the expenditure has been done efficiently or not, and perhaps that's something for you or for the department to do. But I'm not saying that you need to trade off efficiency for a political role in on the continent. I'm just saying that, you know, that's something that you could perhaps follow up better from your side than we can from ours. We can't really engage with the department on its on its auditing process or on the instruments that it's put in place to ensure that the public money is being spent effectively. On the civil society issue, we've talked about that, and I suppose my feeling really is that some kind of panel or forum needs to be established. The Honourable Member Ngoben was talking about that. My feeling is that the state parliament has the resources, and it should be the one making the first move in a way and seeking to set up and reaching out to civil society, putting resources in place to invite people to take part in some sort of policy reference group or such like. But I'm sure you've heard from SANCO and from other organizations a need or a wish to participate in policy type issues, and I think then the ball is really in your court. On that regard, the AU NetHead delinking, it's quite a sort of complex topic. It's not one I'm that familiar with. You're right, the AU is meant to be a geopolitical entity. It is meant to implement NetHead. All I can do really is reiterate what I was trying to say was that there seems to be a shift toward so the peacekeeping, functional, election support, sort of political, technical duties of this organization, and we seem to have lost track a little bit of the necessity of economic development. And it seems that the resources are shifting away towards a more political process and away from economics and development and socioeconomics. So that is really all I was trying to say there. Has Africa, in terms of the United Nations Security Council, yes, the dream, we're all talking about dreams today, the dream was that we would draw attention to Africa, that we would break this cycle of myopism around the superpower interests and the Middle East and so on. Has it happened? doesn't seem like it to me. It seems like, I don't know whether Africa's voice is actually coming out in discussions around the Middle East. It doesn't seem like that to me. Maybe you have a different opinion, my witness, or the HSRC or democracy and governance's concern is that we've sort of been enveloped in sort of mega global politics and in the process of dropped the ball a bit in terms of Africa. On xenophobia, you know, we do have experts at HSRC on xenophobia, and you know, perhaps that's something else for us to take up, chair at another point. I think at root is misunderstanding, fight over scarce resources, stigma and ignorance, and I think in those situations anyone would be xenophobic. But you know, as usual, the way to overcome these things is knowledge and tolerance and understanding that more often than not, migrant communities do not withdraw resources out of communities, they in fact add to them. But that's a hard message to put across, and it's not really what I'm talking about here today. As far as research on the African dream is concerned, honourable member, it's a hard topic. Certainly the quantitative evidence we've come across over the last 13 years since 94 is that an incredibly high level of national pride around South Africa and South Africa's achievements over the last decade and a half. There's no question. I mean, it's extraordinarily high. It's up in the 90% for virtually all groups in the country. So, I mean, we have an immensely constructive, positive basis on which to go forward. Whether that's being whittled away as time goes on, I'm not sure at the moment, but certainly there's no evidence of that so far. How one wants to sort of spell out what that African dream entails is maybe a different question. I agree that a closer relationship with Parliament would be an important interface, I think, between the Human Sciences Research Council and Parliament. You are, after all, our parent, if you like. You know, we sort of draw about 50% of our funding from our parliamentary baseline grant, and there is a willingness across the road, we're in Plain Street, to engage sort of more with the committees in particular. That's our spoke to the Communications Committee a few months ago also about sort of trying to provide more regular sort of research-based inputs on some of the issues that you consider, and I'd be happy to take that up with the chair later around how we could do something a bit more structured in that point of view. We do have expertise on migration, on xenophobia, and on many of the issues that we're talking about, but not necessarily sitting right here. Honourable Gibson asked some questions that we didn't really deal with, to be honest. Douglas Attas, the Parliament, the United States of Africa. I did preface my remark by saying that I was presenting a sort of workshop response to the budget. We did note that the Pan-African Parliament is in the budget, that there are a lot of resources being put into it, that there's high-level backing from the presidency, among others. But didn't really grapple with where it is. I think the idea of a roadmap is an excellent one to transpose a term from other theatres of conflict. But the HSRC, and my unit in particular, is in the middle of negotiating a quite a major project with the department around South Africa's role in Africa. And what I could do is feed that notion into that project with a view to maybe building that into the discussions and into the research, you know, where we do begin to formulate some sort of roadmap. But it hadn't come up, and I can't offer any opinion on what's quite an early process. And I'd like to thank the members again for this opportunity to address you.
In the light of all the responses that have been given, I think we need to take up this matter further of how the committee at some point is going to respond to this engagement with civil society. And I'm saying that we need to look at how we do it. We've been trying a number of things in the committee. Last year we hosted a public hearing on the review of the South African foreign policy in the last 10 years. we held that in Pretoria, as one aspect of the process. It's the first time that this committee tries to do a public hearing on the budget of foreign affairs. So we continue learning as to how we should do that, and of course we should then look at how it went and what have we learned, what were the weaknesses, and then probably plan a next activity so that we can then be able to shift issues around foreign policy to be the domain of the few, but to be taken as an ordinary part of the engagement of the struggle of communities. Because at the end, any relationship and any difficulties you create in the world, it's your citizens that will have to show that responsibility. So we'll continue to learn from that, and of course we'll welcome ideas on that particular aspect. We hope that this will not be the last. The committee will continue to create that particular space, and possibly this being the start that year after year we'll then seek to see how best do we position these public hearings vis-à-vis the budget, and how big and how small do we put them. This was a test case, as I said, that we put this process, and we hope that we have learned the weaknesses and the difficulties that came with it, and will then be able to perfect it. And the reason for us that we may not have that skill, you know, we are different from a committee like Justice that conducts public hearings throughout their engagements. We don't deal with legislation, we don't deal with those issues, so our engagement and our skills in that is very problematic. So we need to engage with the public more, I agree with that. And we need to perfect the way we do that. Yes, we need to follow up on the issue that we are raising in terms of how do we share the information, the research information that is sitting everywhere else. And as members, we do not have access to those institutions that could provide us with information, research documentation. Because in this area of work, you need knowledge. And knowledge you had yesterday might not be relevant today, so you need to keep up every day with the developments and knowledge and see how you position yourself as a committee. And of course, in different areas, you have different relations. Communities deal with these communities that come to South Africa. In their relationship, it affects how we relate to that particular government. That's a link that people have not seen to appreciate that any community that's in this country, unavoidably in engagement with that government of that country, their primary interest will be their citizens in your country. How you treat your citizens, how are their citizens protected, and of course, it raises other issues. Yesterday we were told that when Cote d'Ivoire was an issue, Nigeria had its own interest, Ghana had its own interest in how the conflict is resolved, because it has very serious implications for the citizens. So those are the issues that we will continue to grapple with. But I want to thank you for your attendance, and I want to thank you yourself also for coming through and to discuss with us these issues. I must say that this presents us with the opportunity to learn. It presents us with the opportunity to know how other people see the portfolio committee and how they see how things must be learned and how things should be done. And in fact, one critical issue that has been raised on Honorable Gibson is that this portfolio committee is not as visible as it's supposed to be. So it's something that we need to look at. How do we create that visibility within communities and individuals? Honorable members, it's 12 o'clock. I'm advised that no member, Honorable Kanako Kalako, must leave the meeting until he has gone to get his plate at the back of this hall. So you are all invited for lunch. Thank you.